This is Audible.
Belinda presents this unabridged recording of Alice on White Star, written and read by Isabel Carmody. For my brother Matthew, who talked philosophy at 7. Prelude. The sky was a soup of colours, swirled together, and the sea was restless under it. Waves lapped the shore, fretfully, sighing. A man and woman walked from their car down a steep, curving road to the sea, wearing bathing suits, towels slung around their necks. His shorts were too heavy to dry well. Both wore sunglasses for no other reason than because they had worn them all day. As they rounded the road, they saw the shallow beach. "Well," the man said, and they both stopped. There was a naked pregnant woman, waist deep in the sea. They were both shocked and fascinated. A barefoot man wearing jeans and no shirt prowled the shore, while a big woman clad in a voluminous dark plum dress and shawl sat on a blanket facing the sea, almost obscuring the slight girl with mouse-coloured hair beside her. The woman's brooding presence suggested some ritual in progress, a spell or an archaic binding. The girl might have been a sprite. "Well," the woman murmured at last, shaking herself slightly to dislodge an inexplicable premonition of danger. "Let's go down." Only when they reached the beach did they realize there were others, a plump youth of some 18 or 19 years peering into rock pools, a girl sitting on a rock combing her hair, which some trick of sunlight rendered faintly green. The attention of these young people, like that of the man and the older woman, was focused on the pregnant woman. As they drew nearer the strange group, the woman with the sunglasses noticed that the man in the jeans was extraordinarily good-looking. When he turned to smile at the newcomers, she felt the charm of the smile and responded. It was not until they had come to the end of the path that they saw there was another girl curled up under the bush at the rim of the beach. She was biting her nails. Even from a distance, it was clear she had gone too far and was hurting herself. Unlike the others, her eyes were not on the woman in the water, but on the handsome older man. Feeling self-conscious, the couple piled towels, shoes, and sunglasses together. They swam, keeping carefully to one side of the inlet, leaving the other to the pregnant woman. When they were drying themselves, the woman in plum walked past them to the old van parked in the dunes. She returned with a steaming mug of liquid. "All the comforts of home," said the man. "It's herbal medicine for her," the woman said, nodding towards the pregnant woman. "She's in labour." The couple turned to stare openly at the pregnant woman. She had come into the shallows, and the older man was now positioned behind her, supporting her back with his chest. The watching couple suddenly understood. What was about to take place was both extraordinary and utterly commonplace. A woman was about to give birth. At any given moment, there must be millions of them in the world. The woman resumed her sunglasses automatically and, remembering her own labour in a hospital, felt an echo of the pain, the need to push, the excitement of it all that no one had ever told her about. She could see now that the pregnant woman was doing the shallow panting. Her long red hair was lying in damp streamers down her back and across her swollen belly. It made the woman watching feel both afraid and thrilled. Tonight, she would dream of a woman screaming. The man at her side marvelled at a couple who would offer themselves and the woman's pain and their unborn child up to that sunset, that sea. What did it mean in a world of hospitals and doctors and nuclear fission? What was it saying to the world? To him? He remembered the rank stench as his own daughter was born. How primal the birth, despite the hospital bed, the hovering doctor. As the couple left, the sun was setting, and clouds saturated with night were beginning to reach long fingers over the sky. Again, the woman experienced a stab of unspecified danger, and it occurred to her that her fear was not of the family on the beach, but for them. The man glanced in the rearview mirror as he drove away. Two girls were leading a skittish brown horse between them across the road. They seemed barely able to control it, and he wondered what would happen if it got away from them. 1. It starts with my family, and in a way that's the whole story. There's my mother, Zambia. You probably won't have heard of her. She's the artist, Zambia White Star. Then there's my dad, McCall White Star. His stage name's Mac, and he's the lead guitarist in a band you've probably never heard of that plays a lot of improvised music. Then there's us kids. My older brother, Jesse, my older sister, Miranda, me, Alizon, Serenity, who tries to make us call her Sybil, and the last but not least, our baby brother, Luke. People always lift their eyebrows when I say how many of us there are. 5, they say, lifting their voices up at the end to show how they can hardly believe it. But yes, we do have a pretty big family by ordinary standards. Mostly, people have 2 or 3 kids. Somebody told me the size of a normal family is 2.5 kids. I don't know how they figure the half. I mean, what's half a kid? A baby? In that case, there's 4.5 of us, Luke being the half. Only what he lacks in size, he makes up for in star quality. Ha ha. Da always says we have a cast as big as Ben-Hur, which is this old movie about half-naked muscle men who wrestle lions. Da loves movies. He always says if he had another life, he would be a movie director. Not the kind that makes movies about giant dinosaurs or meteors flattening New York. Art house movies, where you don't have any idea what they're about, but you can't help watching them because they're so weird. And then you come out, and the world seems to have shifted a bit while you are inside. Da says that's the whole point of those movies, to put you off balance, to make you see things from a different angle. I always answer, we White Stars are unbalanced enough already. I mean, you get the picture. This is not your common garden variety family, where Da or Mum goes to work in an office or someplace, and you shop and watch TV in the evenings and go for barbecues on the weekends. For a start, Mum and Dad work weird hours. Mum paints at night. She's what's called nocturnal. She sleeps in the daytime and gets up and eats breakfast while the rest of us eat dinner. The best part of her being up all night is that if you wake up with a bad dream or you can't sleep, you can go to her studio. She wraps you in her shawls and lets you curl up in the corner of her tatty old studio couch while she makes Vegemite toast and pots of herbal tea, and you eventually fall asleep watching her paint, bathed in moonlight. Da only works at night when he has a gig. Generally, he and his band rehearse 4 days a week, in the afternoons and some nights. He earns a living arranging other people's music and giving music lessons. The rest of the time, he's either practicing his guitar or composing his own music. To say we're not rich is an understatement. There's a few good months, a lot of bad months, and the occasional ugly month when we're not having milk in our tea or butter on our bread, and bills with red type and a nasty tone come in the mail because of what Da calls the gap. That means the difference between when you ask somebody to pay you and when you actually get the money. When I was small, I thought the gap was this big crack in the pavement out the front of our place, which had appeared when a truck mounted the curb one night. It was wide enough that little kids needed help to step over it, and old ladies with canes were always tutting at it. What used to scare me about it was that you couldn't see how deep it was, no matter how hard you looked. It was too dark, and I was too scared to reach in and see if I could feel the bottom. One day, the man up the road saw me lying on my belly staring into it, and he told me to watch out for the bears. Somehow, that gave me this creepy idea that there was a dark underworld of bears, and the crack opened onto it. But it wasn't wide enough for them to escape, though that's what they wanted to do more than anything in the world. They wanted to get out and tear out the throats of all us puny hairless bears living up here in the sunlight. They thought humans were mutant bears whose fur had fallen out, but they couldn't find a way to escape. So they would come to the crack and gaze up at us. Whenever I stepped over it, I could feel their eyes glittering with bloodlust and hate. Whenever Da warned us that the gap was widening, I would have nightmares about the bears, fearing that they had figured out a way to open up the crack enough to escape and eat all of us stupid hairless bears. Of course I grew out of thinking the bears were down there. I still got a feeling of unease when Da talked about the gap. Da says it doesn't matter about being poor, because everyone should live on the edge some of the time. Reminds you you're alive. One bit of me agrees with him, but another bit of me feels like it would be a bit easier if you didn't live too close to the edge all the time. We kids go to school like regular kids. The truth is, I like school. I'd get bored if I was home all the time just doing anything I wanted, like Jesse. Da tutored us all in music, of course. He taught us piano and guitar, but I'm the only one who doesn't play anything. All that teaching couldn't seem to take hold in me. It just slipped out as fast as Da fed it in, until he said kindly that maybe I took after Mum. That might be okay, if it wasn't for the fact that most of the others are artistic as well. Mum says it's because I haven't developed the right side of my brain yet. Da thinks it's because I haven't found my form. It was different with the others. Jesse plays blues on his guitar. Miranda plays saxophone in a jazz group with some kids at school. And Serenity plays cello really well. Well, she used to, anyway. Da says it doesn't matter about me and Mum not being musical, because somebody needs to be the audience. What I'm trying to say here is that in a family of extraordinary and talented people, I am the odd one out, the chook in a house of peacocks. The worst of it is, the others really are peacocks. Mum has stunning blue eyes, masses of wavy red hair, and pale, soft skin. Miranda takes after her, except she's blonde. Da, Serenity, and Jesse have thick, wavy, coal-black hair and blue eyes. Jesse's kind of overweight, but he's still really nice-looking. Da is so handsome that some of the girls at school make swooning faces when he goes by, and female teachers always talk to him for longer than any other parent at parent-teacher nights. Luke has only been in the world for half a second or so we don't know how he'll end up looking. But right now, he has creamy skin, a fluff of inky curls, and opaque blue eyes. I have this pale brown, straight hair that won't grow past my shoulders without splitting, and grey eyes. Smoky, Da says. That makes them sound a lot more interesting than they really are. I'm kind of skinny and short, too. Compact, Da says, which makes me sound like the economy size. Maybe I'm the half in the White Star family. I'm a bit ashamed to admit that though I never minded having no talent, I did mind being plain and untalented. But who could I blame? Mum and Da can't help the way their genes work together to make me. I guess even genes have their off days. That was how I thought of us before the accident. I had everybody all worked out and filed. Mum was full of impractical romantic visions that made her inattentive to the real world. Jesse was lazy and absent-minded. Miranda was bossy and superior and tactless. Sybil, Serenity, was moody and getting moodier. Luke was sweet but just a baby. And Da, he was kind and generous and easygoing and filled with integrity. And he loved music. 2. When I think back, I always come to this thing that happened just before everything changed forever. Our English class went to the office of the Coastal Telegraph, our local newspaper, on an excursion that had been arranged by our English teacher, Mrs. Barker. First, the editor told us what his job was. Then he passed us on to a sad-looking little man called Eddie, who took us downstairs to look at the old part of the building where they used to set some of the print by hand. Eddie explained that people used to fit every letter of the headlines into a metal box, which was fixed onto rollers and inked. Then paper was pressed against it, sort of like a huge stamp set. We saw these enormous wheels of paper in a machine that used to roll them over those inked metal pages. It was exactly like you see in the movies when something happens and they supposedly show the front page headlines being rolled out. Except it was all frozen forever, like dinosaurs in a museum. "That's not how newspapers get put together now," Eddie said, sounding wistful. "All the typing and laying out, that's the way the stories and photographs are organized on a page. That gets done on computers now." Eddie abandoned us in a staff canteen where we were to have lunch. Marilyn Bobbitt whispered loudly to Sylvia Yarrow that Grey Eddie seemed a bit like one of the components of those old machines. Sylvia giggled and said he looked like he was obsolete too. I spent lunchtime pretending to eat and covertly watching Harlan Sanderson flirt with the elderly canteen attendant. After lunch, a cheerful guy called Clary showed up and took us to where the advertising was laid out. He told us that newspapers were really only there so people could advertise things they wanted to sell. Journalists were too silly to know any better. He grinned when he said that to show he was joking, but you could see it was what he really thought. He took us to a tiny room where there was a typewriter-like machine called a teleprinter. He said it used to spit out news from agencies all over the world, but now they had the internet. He left us with a girl called Riley. I don't know if that was her last name or her first. Her job, she told us, was to sift through the mass of stuff on the internet for backfill. This was information that journalists might use to compile other stories, or for research, or it might be stories that were about our region. She printed these out and filed them or passed them on to anyone who might be doing a story and could use them. Sometimes journalists would ask her to track down information for them. She showed us the computer room, where news was coming in, and said that she often knew first when some big story was breaking. Then we had a look at the photo file before going to the boardroom, where a journalist was going to give us a talk to finish up the day. We'd been waiting about 25 minutes, and the natives were getting restless, when in walked this guy with dark brown restless eyes, short black hair, and a loose way of walking and moving, as if he wasn't properly screwed together at the joints. He wore a dark grey suit that looked expensive, though he wasn't all that old. He told us his name was Gary Solomon, and that he was an A-grade journalist. Then he launched confidently into this talk about journalism as a career. It sounded like something he had memorized, and you got the feeling he was just unwinding a spool. But when he said a journalist couldn't afford to get emotionally involved, Jezebel Astor broke in to ask him if he'd ever done a story that got to him. That seemed to stump him, and we all waited to see what he would say. I thought he was probably just going to jump back into his prepared rave, but he frowned and said in a slower, less confident voice, "It's funny you should ask. You need to be detached. But I guess every journalist has stories that get past the barrier you try to set up. For me, it was something that happened when I was on court rounds the first time. It was a case about an older boy who'd murdered his younger brother. It wasn't an accident. The older brother had written in his diary that he wanted to murder his brother and described how he'd do it, and then he did it. He took the kid to this bit of track, saying they were going to flatten coins on the rails, and when a train came along, he pushed him under it. The whole room was so silent that anyone entering might have thought it was empty. I glanced around and saw how stunned people looked. All the sarcasm and laughter had been wiped away. "Why did he do it?" Jezebel finally asked. Gary Solomon nodded. "Well, that's what I wanted to know. That's what the court wanted to know. The guy who did it was 18. The little brother was 10. I kept thinking it must have been an accident. The guy didn't seem that bright. Maybe he just didn't get it that when he pushed his brother under the train, he'd stay dead. Maybe he thought he'd get up like the coyote after the train runs over him in the cartoon. That was the tack the defense took." "But didn't the guy say why he'd done it? Didn't someone ask him?" Jezebel demanded. "His defense came up with all sorts of reasons. He'd been depressed. His father was out of work. He'd ditched school and was bored. But when they asked him, he said he'd thought of doing it, and then he did it. He got a suspended sentence because the judge decided he wasn't responsible. He had to have psychiatric treatment. But what got to me was, and I didn't believe he was mad. And yet if he wasn't mad, then why had he done it? I guess that's why I'm a journalist in the end, because I want to know the real reason." He looked so intensely at us that it made me uncomfortable. It was like he really expected us to tell him why that guy had murdered his brother. I noticed Harlan Sanderson had this funny look on his face, and I thought he was going to make one of his smart, serious summing-up statements and get us all off the journalist's hook. But instead, Simon Wheels, who was sitting next to him, waved his paw in the air and asked if the journalist wore Y-fronts. It was the stupidest thing to say, but everyone cracked up, mostly out of relief at having that demanding silence broken. Mrs. Barker came in then, looking like she wanted to ask why we were laughing. She introduced herself to the journalist and apologized for missing the start of his talk. Then Harlan broke in with his smooth, deep voice and asked what training you needed to be a journalist. Gary Solomon went back to lecture mode, saying he'd gone to university and majored in journalism and communications, all the while bombarding the Coastal Telegraph with applications for a cadetship until they offered him a job. Then Sylvia asked, in her slightly sneering voice, what use newspapers were anyway. Only old people read them. You see the news on the internet about a minute after it happens. Why would anyone bother with newspapers? Barry Solomon answered her seriously, but not as if he wanted to convince her of anything. His voice had gone back to being cool and confident.
Newspapers offer some very specific advantages over television or the internet. The main thing is that you can take your time reading a newspaper story and think about what you're reading. Television journalism mostly offers news as entertainment. It's the news via Steven Spielberg.
One of the boys said loudly that it just meant he wasn't good enough for television, and another boy said, "You mean he's too ugly?"
"That's enough," Mrs. Barker snapped.
She thanked Gary Solomon for his time and herded us out, her face set in a stony expression. 3. That night, I caught the bus home with Miranda because we came out of the school gate at the same time. I was late because of the detention Mrs. Barker had given the class, and Miranda had been practicing in the gym with the jazz kids. We didn't bother waiting for Serenity, who was always late but wouldn't be seen dead coming home with anyone, let alone her sisters. Miranda was in purple. She even had a purple rinse through her hair. Amethyst, she calls it. She says it's a healing colour, though I don't know which part of her she thinks needs healing. If all purple, it was green. I only wear dark colours except for my jeans, mainly because you can't see the dirt on them, and also because I don't have to try to figure out what colours to wear together. Serenity wears black, but she's not a goth. She's just in mourning for the world. "What do you think of when I say evil?" Miranda asked as we got off the bus. I shrugged and switched my bag to the other shoulder. "I guess it's when people do things like kill one another." I was thinking of the case the journalist had told us about, wondering if Gary Solomon would have been satisfied with the idea that the guy who killed his brother was evil. "Do you think of murder as evil?" Miranda sounded disappointed. "Well, I don't think evil exists as a force. I think deeds can be evil." "But what's the difference between a bad or wrong thing and an evil thing?" she interrupted. "I think it's evil when you know it's bad and it will cause harm and you want to do it anyway." Miranda shook her purple hair impatiently. "So are loggers evil when they push aside protesters and chop down an ancient tree?" "Mostly, I think they just feel they're in the right, and they want to let people know they're angry." "But can a person be evil?" Miranda asked, sounding frustrated. "What, like a vampire or something?" I asked. The annoying thing about Miranda in this sort of conversation is that you know she has the whole discussion mapped out in her head, and when she asks a question, it's only to get the answer she expects, so that she can draw the conclusion she has already come to. "Idiot," she said, sounding disgusted. "Vampires aren't real." "Well, that's what I mean. I think only fictional characters are evil. I think there are evil actions, not evil people." "What about Ted Bundy, the serial killer?" Now she sounded triumphant. I mulled over that. "I think Ted Bundy was an anomaly. He was human, but some bit of him was something else, and that was the bit that did all of the murdering." Miranda was silent for a while. Then she said, "The band says purple's not the right look for jazz. They say I should wear black or sequins." "What's that got to do with evil?" I asked. She looked at me as if I were a fool. "What are you talking about?" I sighed and let it drop, though I thought the conversation about evil was a lot more interesting than the one about clothes. "Tell the band you'll wear what you want. Where are they going to get another sax player as good as you?" She nodded. "Yeah, but I don't like to take such an aggressive stance." "Why don't you ask Dad?" I suggested. "Poor old Dad," Miranda said, shaking her head fondly. "He's not exactly with it musically." "You shut up," I said. "His music's great." "Like you'd know," Miranda couldn't help saying. I walked faster. "I'm sorry," she said, catching up. "Stop galloping." I slowed down, but I was still mad. I hated it when she talked that way about Dad. "I said I was sorry," she said impatiently. "Don't be such a grump. I can't help it if Da's music's just not where it's at." "Where what's at?" I asked coldly. "Oh, come on, Ali. I just mean Da might be your knight in shining armour, but he's never going to rock the world, that's all." I said nothing, because we'd reached our gate. Miranda pushed it open and went through. I lingered to close it, wanting to be away from her. By the time I climbed the steps and came through the door, Miranda had gone upstairs to her room, muttering about needing to charge her phone. I went down the hall to the kitchen to find Jess sauteing mushrooms in pesto, and Dad talking to Mel and Titch from his band about a gig they'd been offered. He was nursing Luke, who was gurgling happily in his arms.
"Well, I guess it's a break for us,"
Mel said, in his usual gloomy way.
"Fronting Urban Dingo is more than a break," Titch protested. "Everyone's saying they're the next big thing. I can't believe they'd ask us."
"Cost-cutting," said Mel. "Giving local bands a go," said Da.
He noticed me and smiled. "Hello, Alizon." "Hi, everyone." I felt angry at Da all of a sudden. Maybe Miranda was right about him, never breaking into the big time. He gave music everything he had, but it gave so little back, and we had to live with that. How could he smile when he was a failure?
"Bad day, Alizon?" Da asked, as if he read my thoughts.
I sighed. Detention after school. An hour of watching the boys throw spitballs at the roof.
"What was the detention for?" Mel asked, pushing day-glow orange dreadlocks out of his eyes.
I shrugged. "Some of the kids were messing around on an excursion."
"Some of the kids?" Dad asked gently.
I might have laughed a bit, I admitted. We smiled at one another.
"Typical," Mel said. "Schools are outdated fascist institutions. It'd be much better if there weren't any schools. We should all be teachers and students our whole life long."
"Do you want me to have a word to the teacher?" Dad asked.
I kissed Luke. "Of course not. I'll take Luke up and see if Mum's in the shower," I offered, shedding my bag. I scooped Luke up, feeling amazed all over again at how little he weighed. If I didn't know better, I would think I was holding a bundle of bunny rugs. I smelled his head, loving the milky, soapy scent of him.
"He'll be asleep if Zambia doesn't hurry up," Dad said, giving me a smile.
I was in my room after dinner writing a report for science when Serenity came in, loaded with library books. I don't know how many of them she reads, but Miranda reckons it's so we can tell her biographers how she used to lug around masses of heavy books. Serenity and I share a bedroom, so my half of the room is decorated by me, which is to say, is not decorated. The other half of the room is painted black, and Serenity's bed is draped in black satin. There are no pictures other than a magazine clipping which shows Sylvia Plath doing a reading. The mirror on her half of the room is always turned to the wall, and she has a vase with a single white lily on her bedside table. It's like sharing a room with Morticia Adams. She put her books away and changed from her school uniform into black home clothes, then took out her cello and began tightening the bow. Then she began to tune the cello. When she was satisfied, she laid the bow beside the cello and started gnawing ferociously at her nails. "Do you have to do that?" I asked, disgusted. I could actually hear the little thunk as she chomped through another bit. "Much shorter, and you'll officially be a cannibal."
"You are such a nothing," Serenity hissed and stalked out,
which left me feeling glum, because it was pretty much how I saw myself. I was reading an hour later when Miranda came in and gestured at me to come downstairs. As soon as I got into the hall, I heard snatches of a woman's high-pitched voice.
"Stupendous reaction! Marvellous!"
The voice and superlatives belonged to Mum's agent, Rona Wojciech. I grimaced. Jesse padded out of the bathroom, still wearing his pyjamas and carrying his guitar. He plays in the shower recess because he says the acoustics are good. Despite the fact that he can really play and practices all the time, he always refuses Star's invitations to join the band, and he never tried out for any other bands either.
"Who is it?" he asked.
"Rona," I said, wrinkling my nose. "She's come for Mum's paintings for the exhibition." He rolled his eyes and went to his bedroom. Rona was sitting at the kitchen table when I went in, incredibly tall, frighteningly skinny, with collarbones that stick out far enough to stack books on.
"Brilliant," she was saying. "Such a wonderfully moody new series."
She glanced up from the sheet of slides as I entered and gave me the faintly puzzled look everyone gives me, as if they're wondering what I'm here for.
I wonder that too. Hi, Rona, I said, blinking a bit at her skin-tight pink dress and her turban, thinking that if I'd been a buyer, I wouldn't have listened to a word she said about art. The only good thing about Rona was her continued faith in Mum, which Mum treated as if it were a sort of slow wasting disease that she would probably die from one day. Rona had lost interest in me and was studying her iPhone with a perplexed look. I slid some bread into the toaster and pressed the lever down, asking Da, "Where's Luke?"
"The land of Nod."
He waved a hand at the baby monitor, whose counterpart hung on the wall above Luke's bassinet.
"That's a stunning ensemble," Rona told Miranda, who entered wearing purple boots, purple tights, and a violet tie-dyed petticoat with ragged lace.
She looked at me.
"You ought to wear a bit of colour once in a while, Alison. It would brighten you up."
I ate a tomato, cheerfully thinking there was definitely hope for me if Rona disliked how I looked. A picture of Harlan Sanderson crept into my mind, and I felt my face grow hot. Harlan was way out of my league in the human attraction stakes, but that didn't stop me from daydreaming. Mum came into the room. No, strike that. Mum glided into the room wearing a long floating shift of green chiffon over black leggings. She had caught her hair up in a jeweled comb, but red curls were spilling artistically in all directions.
"Darling!"
Rona shrilled, rising and holding her arms open wide. Da and I grinned at one another covertly as Mum went forward and allowed herself to be enfolded in long pink arms. It looked like some sort of carnivorous stick insect consuming a butterfly.
"You look marvellous, Sambia."
"That's very pink, Rona," Mum said. Luke started to fuss, so she rearranged her clothes to feed him, and Rona averted her eyes. She thought artists had no business breeding. Their work ought to be progeny enough, she had told Mum the previous year, when she learned of the new pregnancy 13 years after the last. Then she had hinted about abortion.
"Oh, no,"
Mum had said, blissfully dismissive. "But this will be the last. I sense it."
"I hope you sense yourself using contraception in the future."
Rona had been shattered enough to be slightly acerbic, but it was wasted on Mum.
"This one is needed in the world," Mum had said dreamily. "Serenity, so much black," Rona said now, as Serenity came in.
"Sybil," Serenity corrected her coldly. We all trooped out to wrap and pack the paintings, leaving Mum in the kitchen feeding Luke. Rona came along behind us, poking holes in the lawn with her stiletto heels.
"She should use professional movers," Rona said, as usual.
"We can't afford it," Da said, also as usual.
It took almost an hour, and there were just a couple of smaller paintings left to be fitted in when Mum asked me to take Luke and put him in his capsule in Rona's hatchback. It was just starting to rain as I came out carrying him. I noticed the back of the van was open and went round to see if the rain was getting in. That's when it happened. Our cat, a monstrously overweight grey tabby called Wombat, jumped from the roof of the house onto the uplifted flap of the van. It was designed to stay open, but once it started to close, it fell like a guillotine. I felt the rush of air, and some instinct made me step forward rather than back, so the door smashed down on my forehead with all the force of a falling piano instead of on Luke's. A skyrocket exploded with incredible, painful intensity inside my skull, and all the strength seemed to go out of my knees. "Luke," I whispered fearfully as the darkness ate me. 4.
"Alison!"
Someone shouted my name so loudly that it hurt. I could smell roses so strongly, it was as if someone had shoved them up my nose. At the same time, depression crawled like a mass of black beetles inside the smell. I wanted to speak, but it was too hard.
"Alison White Star!"
The same voice shouting at me and stinking of roses and wet dirt, yelling my whole name like an incantation, pushing sorrow and roses down my throat and into my ears. I tried to open my eyes, but they were glued shut. I tried to speak, but I couldn't find my mouth to let the words out.
"Alison, come on now. Wake up."
A hand lightly slapping a cheek that might be mine if I could ever find it.
The voice tasted of snot and tears and despair. A finger on my eye, lifting the lid. Light speared into my brain. The touch was worse. Despair leaked from the fingertips and burned into me. A flashing image of an older man lying in a bed, pale and emaciated. I tried to pull away, but the movement started an earthquake that threatened to tear my head apart. "Better not to move!" the rose-scented stranger shouted, taking the hand away. Then, "She's awake!"
"Alison!"
Dar's voice. He was yelling too. I turned my eyes towards the voice and was enveloped in the smell of fresh coffee grounds, which was weird because Dar didn't drink coffee. Mingled in with the smell of coffee was a sharp ammoniac stink that filled me with a sick, tense apprehension. I opened my eyes properly, and the skull's splitting brightness resolved slowly into white faces around the edge of a suspended light. I didn't understand until it occurred to me that I was lying down, and they were leaning over me, Da and a woman with short dark hair.
"Good!"
the woman yelled, leaning closer and touching my hand. The smell of roses and wet earth pressing on me, along with a feeling of terrible, exhausted grief.
"Alison, you're in the hospital. Do you remember what happened?"
Fear gouged into my heart, sliced through the anxiety and grief and the oppressive smells. "Look." It came out as a rusty creak of sound.
Da gave a sobbing, bellowing laugh. "He's all right, love. You managed to fall with him on top of you."
Pride and love blazed out of his eyes at me, and the smell of coffee and ammonia was swallowed up by the smell of caramelized sugar and the pungent tang of pine needles.
"Who is Luke?" the woman shouted. "Luke is our baby, Dr. Reed," Di yelled at her. "She was holding him when it happened."
"Of course. Doctor," I thought, as the woman leaned over me. I was afraid she would touch me again. I shrank back, and she frowned, a pulling together of black brows. I realized I could see all the hairs coming out of her skin, as if I were looking at her through a magnifying glass. Pores on her face looked like mouths gaping at me. The smell of roses and wet earth pushed at me. I turned my head away from her to escape it, but I found myself looking at a row of other beds with patients in them, and doctors and visitors around the beds in little clots. A tidal wave of muddled smells flooded towards me, forced its way down my throat, up my nose, through my eyes, my fingertips, choking me, blinding me, suffocating me. My stomach revolted. It punched the world out of me in a great vomiting gout, and I fell back, empty, into the silent darkness.
"Alison,"
the woman's voice again. It reached into the dark, caught me, and dragged me up out of the peaceful void. I opened my eyes in fear. This time, the room was dim and very quiet. The doctor was seated in a chair beside my bed. I could still smell her wet earth and roses perfume, but nowhere near as strongly.
"I'm Dr. Reed," she said softly,
and I relaxed slightly, relieved she wasn't going to shout at me.
"Do you remember hitting your head?"
"Yes."
"Look, your little brother's fine," she said.
The slight smell of cloves drifted to me.
"Your family will bring him in to visit as soon as I let them know you've woken."
What's wrong with me?" I asked.
"Just a concussion from a very hard bump on the head."
She paused.
"Alison, it seems as if your memory's intact. Can you tell me what happened just before you blacked out last time?"
I'm not sure. Everything seemed so bright and loud, and there was so much shouting and crying, and all of these weird smells."
She nodded, as if she'd expected the answer. "A hard bang on the head can cause your senses to become confused and magnified, and produce a lot of odd sensations. How is it now?"
"I can still smell a lot of stuff that, well, that doesn't seem to come from anything, but it's not as bad as it was. No one's yelling."
"I had the nurses give you a drug to dull your senses slightly when I thought that might be the reason you were not waking up. But don't worry, they'll gradually go back to normal."
"How long have I been here?" I asked.
Another silence, this one longer and as heavy as a block of metal.
The smell of cloves grew stronger, but there was also a peppermint smell.
"You've been here for a month," Dr. Reed said.
I was so shocked. I didn't know what to say.
"It's somewhat unusual for a blackout caused by concussion to last so long, but not unheard of. In any case, you're awake now," Dr. Reed said briskly. She stood up. "Well, I'd better let your father know the good news. He's walking in the grounds."
At the door, she hesitated.
"Try to rest, and don't worry about anything."
After she closed the door behind her, I felt limp with exhaustion.
"Alison,"
Dar's voice groped for me, and I let it lift me gently to wakefulness. The room was still dark, and Dar was kneeling beside the bed. Again, I could smell coffee grounds, but as with Dr. Reed, it was weaker than when I had first woken. One odd thing was that the pine needle smell seemed stronger than when I had first smelled it. And I reminded myself that I wasn't smelling any of those things. It was my confused senses making them up, and it would be a lot worse without the sense-numbing drugs Dr. Reed had prescribed.
"Duh, Dr. Reed says I've been asleep for a month," I whispered. "What's wrong with me?"
"Nothing permanent, I swear," Dad promised. The pine needle smell seemed to get stronger. "Dr. Reed says he can come home in a couple of days. They just want to do a few tests first."
"What sort of tests?"
"They're a bit puzzled about why you slept so long." Maybe I looked scared, because Dad touched my hand lightly, and at once I seemed to feel his fear pressing against me like a hot, panting dog. I shifted my hand away.
"What happened about Mum's show?"
Dar gave a breathy laugh. "The last thing Zambi has wanted to think about is exhibiting."
"You didn't miss the gig with Urban Dingo?"
He laughed incredulously. "You remember that? It's coming up. I wanted to pull out, but the band would have lost the gig. Now I don't have to worry. Maybe you'll be well enough to come along and cheer old Dar on."
"Maybe," I said, thinking, "he's telling me he wasn't sure I would wake up."
That evening, Dr. Reed came with another doctor, and they did a series of tests. The next day I had a CAT scan and some other tests that involved electrodes being glued to my head and connected to beeping machines. Nothing hurt, but it seemed to me that the doctor's presence was the hardest thing to endure because of how the concussion had affected my senses. I was drained by the smells and the bursts of emotion whenever they touched me. At one point, I tried to tell Dr. Reed about how the smells seemed to be associated with people, but a doctor I had not seen before had come in to mess with the machines, and he snapped at me. There were no smells. I was just imagining them because of the concussion. Then he started talking to Dr. Reed about prescribing a stronger sense suppressant. He came over to the bedside as he spoke, and I nearly gagged because he stank horribly. When I saw that Dr. Reed didn't react, I realized I was imagining the smell. Weirdly, when I looked at Dr. Reed, I could only smell roses and a sort of disinfectant smell and dirt, and even though her expression was politely interested, I had the strong impression that she didn't like the other doctor. He said that she preferred to phase out the sense suppressants altogether. He started to argue, and Dr. Reed gave a pointed glance at me, and they left the room. I was glad, because whether or not his smell was imaginary, it was really revolting. I listened and was surprised to find that I could make out some of the words the two doctors were saying, even though the door was closed.
"Hysterical, typical schoolgirl. These drugs could be," the other doctor said.
"Dr. Austin, I don't..."
"Not necessarily," Dr. Reed murmured.
I stopped listening and went back into the darkness, exhausted.
5. I probably sound stupid, because I didn't recognize what had happened right away. But finding I'd been in a month-long coma was a shock, and for a while I was always so tired that it was hard to think. I was discharged a couple of days later after a whole lot more tests that showed nothing. I felt fine, except for the fact that my senses went on, bringing me weird and unwanted smells and surges of feelings, even with the sense suppressant. I was beginning to dread the thought of it wearing off. What if I were bombarded with stuff like the first time I woke and went into a coma again? If it hadn't been for the odious Dr. Austin wanting to keep me on the stuff,
I might have asked Dr. Reed if I could keep taking it. But as it was, Dr. Reed gave me one last pill before Dad took me home, telling me the drug would work its way out of my system over a week, and that my own senses would gradually readjust. On the drive home, Dad told me they'd organized a little welcome home party for me. I think he wanted to make sure it was all right. I didn't know if it was or not. I could smell coffee grounds on him, and also a little bit of the ammonia stink, but there was also the lovely caramelized sugar smell. It was as if Dad really was smelling of those things. Maybe it was because I was thinking about smells, that the first thing I noticed when I went inside the house was how it smelled. I stopped inside the front door, sniffed, and gave a sigh of pleasure. It wasn't just that they'd cooked a feast of all my favorite things, or that they'd filled the place with flowers. It was like the house itself gave off one of those not-real fragrances my senses had got into the habit of conjuring up in response to people. The sweetness of it seemed wonderfully familiar, and I was still trying to figure out what it was as Da ushered me gently along the hall. They were all sitting around the kitchen table, even Serenity. They smiled at me, and I had to work really hard to keep the smile on my own face, because for a second I nearly staggered back under the force of their attention. It seemed to push at me like a strong wave at the beach. Then there were the smells: cut grass, hot strawberries, expensive perfume, violets, and licorice. A pot began to boil over. Jesse raced for it, and Miranda yelled at him not to use the tea towel, but to get a dishcloth. The minute they turned their attention away from me, I felt as if a truck that had been pressing on me pulled back. I sat down on the nearest stool, my legs shaking. Before I could begin to think about what had happened, Mum pushed Luke into my arms. Still dazed and confused, I looked down into his face. He smelled of the same smell as the house, but he had changed so much while I slept. He had been an unopened bud, and now his little hands waved around and reached out for things. The cloudy blue of his eyes had become a lovely greenish grey. He was looking at me, just as the others had done, but I didn't get any feeling of pressure from his gaze. It rested on me with the same sticky light innocence as his fingers, asking nothing, saying nothing. Gradually I grew calmer. It was as if a tiny stream of quiet was trickling into me from him, and the longer I looked, the deeper the pool of quiet became, until eventually it soothed all the tangled, taut nerves and sinews in my body. I was fascinated to find that whenever I was forced to look up to answer a question, and the pressure of my family's combined attention became intolerable, I had only to look down at Luke to feel soothed and gentled again. I ate a bit, but the meal tasted as bland as hospital food because of the drug in my system. I didn't have that much appetite anyway, and it was awkward to eat holding Luke, but I didn't want to let him go. I followed Mum's lead, smiling a lot without saying much, and pretty soon everyone dropped back into their usual roles. Mum stared dreamily into the candle flames and smiled at me from time to time. Das served and laughed and broke into little bursts of song. Jesse strummed at his guitar and talked about some complicated article he'd read in a paper. Serenity chewed her nails and stared out the window, and Miranda talked about her boyfriend Ricky while she sewed the hem on a yellow skirt. She had shifted from purple to yellow while I was unconscious, and her wardrobe was going through an overhaul. I sat, happy to be among them, although it seemed to me the whole family had grown louder. And not only them. The radio was turned down, but I kept being distracted by its low babble. Then there was the phone ringing, people chewing their food and laughing or grunting, Jesse strumming his guitar. And the smells. Even with my senses depressed, I could smell so many things. Garlic, bread, bananas, dust, sweat, and a whole host of other things, as well as smells that were obviously imaginary. Drifts of expensive perfume that seemed to come from Mum, though she never wore any perfume. Dad's fresh coffee grounds smell, tinged strongly with caramelized sugar and pine needles. Smoke, though there was no fire in the hearth. Even the smell of rain, though it was completely dry outside. My sense of smell had gone completely haywire. In less than an hour, I started feeling really exhausted, and Da, who must have been watching for it, said I should go to bed. I didn't argue. Jessie stepped forward to take Luke. I gave him up reluctantly, my hand brushing against Jessie's. The cut grass smell instantly became very strong, and I got this stunning jolt of static electricity and the feeling of something enormous and dreadfully cramped, seething and churning inside Jessie, wanting to get out. When he glanced into my face to say good night, I could tell from his expression that he had felt nothing. 15 minutes later, I was in bed, and though I wanted to think about what had happened with Jessie, I was asleep before my head hit the pillow. I didn't wake up again until the afternoon of the next day, and everyone was worrying. Over breakfast, which still tasted bland, I told them I was fine. Jessie said I just needed to get used to being awake again. I held Luke and stayed up for a little, but then I felt tired and went back to bed and slept some more, and that's how it went on for a week. Me waking for a little while and feeling fine, fending off the attention of too many people by holding Luke, and then getting tired of the noises and smells, which grew stronger each day as the sense suppressant wore off. So I would go to bed and sleep and sleep. Eventually, Dad took me back to the hospital, and they did some more tests. Most of it was fine, except for the odour that came off Dr. Austin. He hovered around the whole time they were doing the tests, and it was 1,000 times worse than it had been when my senses had been dulled by the suppressant. I was terrified that he would insist on examining me. The thought of him touching me made me want to scream. At one point, I was alone with Dr. Reed in her office, and I tried to describe these new sensations, but her smell of roses and wet dirt was very strong, and it distracted me. I had the feeling that Dr. Reed was distracted too, as if half of her was somewhere else, but I babbled on and on, struggling to find words to describe things that didn't make sense and getting more and more muddled. Suddenly I became angry with her for not paying attention. "I'm not making this stuff up," I burst out. The rose and dirt smell faded into clothes. "No one says you're making anything up, Alison," Dr. Reed answered evenly. "Don't the tests show anything?" I asked. She tapped the pen on the edge of the desk. "Alison, how are things at home?" I didn't like the sound of that. "What do you mean?" "Oh, it's possible that if you're having some trouble adjusting, it might not be anything to do with your senses." "You think this is all in my mind?" I demanded. I felt mad, but I was so exhausted that my anger slipped into a sort of loose irritation at the suffocating dirt and rose smell that was rising from her yet again. "Why do you always wear that rose perfume?" I asked crossly. She stared at me. "I beg your pardon?" I shook my head, too tired to explain. So home we went again. On the way, Da said, "You don't have to think about going to school until you're ready." I smiled, too weary to hold up the other half of a conversation. The truth was that school seemed like it belonged to another life. I couldn't imagine ever going there again. I couldn't imagine having a normal life. Then, one day, I woke up and looked at the bedside clock, as I always did, to see how long I had slept. It was 10 in the morning on a Tuesday, and I hadn't woken that early since before the accident. I just lay there for a while. The bed seemed so soft and warm, and I let myself sink into the feeling. How had I never noticed what a perfectly wonderful bed it was, the way the pillows were exactly the right height and softness, and how beautiful the rich red of the quilt cover was, like sleeping wrapped in a cotton dusk. I turned to snuggle deeper, and my eyes fell on Serenity's side of the room. I had never much liked Serenity's mortuary decor, but since the accident, all of the blackness she surrounded herself with seemed heavy and almost tangible, like huge lumps of jellied night. Whenever she was in the bedroom, I heard this sinister whispering, obviously another trick of my haywire senses, but even so it fitted. I shuddered and turned onto my other side, but I could still feel her half of the room behind my back, the white of the death lily glowing in the midst of the blackness like some ghastly fang.
"Get a grip," I muttered. I noticed how silent the house was. I thought of the day of the Triffids, where the main character wakes up one day and can't hear any of the normal things he would have heard, and that's the signal that the world as he knew it had ended. Only I could still hear cars, and even the air brakes of trucks on the highway that ran past the other side of our neighborhood. The silence was inside the house, and it made me think how noisy everything was since the accident. It was my senses, of course, exaggerating things. It was an incredible relief to hear nothing but my own breathing and the ticking of my bedside clock. I padded downstairs barefoot and found a note saying Jessie had taken Mum and Luke to the clinic. Da had scribbled a P.S. on the bottom of the note, saying he'd gone to rehearse at Mel's place but would be back in time for his afternoon student. He didn't usually rehearse on days when he had students, but the band was working hard on material for the upcoming Urban Dingo gig. That explained the silence. I was the only one home. I felt an incredible surge of relief, and something in me that had been coiled tight, unwound. The minute I relaxed, I discovered that I was ravenously hungry. The box from the health food shop was sitting on the table. Once a week, when she remembered, Mum poked a list under the door of the shop, and they delivered the next day. Among the supplies were fresh mushrooms. I decided to make mushroom risotto for dinner as a way of signalling to the family that I was on the way back, because suddenly it seemed that it might really be so. I melted butter and chopped garlic and mushrooms to fry it in. Then I stirred in brown rice and vegetable stock. I hadn't cooked since the accident, and the scent of the fresh mushrooms and garlic seemed almost intoxicating. I took a long, deep breath and felt like I had never smelled mushrooms before that moment, that all other mushrooms in the world were pale shadows of these ones, the garlic, the blueprint for all garlic. I wanted to laugh, but I couldn't jolly myself out of the intensity of what I was feeling. It occurred to me, as I dished out a bowl full of risotto, that for the first time, I wasn't resisting the new intensity of my senses. I sprinkled on Parmesan cheese and ate a mouthful, concentrating on the taste. The flavour was like a small but very potent explosion in my mouth, making me dizzy for a moment. I felt like I could eat that risotto and die, because it was so complete in every way that it contained the meaning of life. The tastes, the feeling of the grains of buttery rice against my tongue, the soft pieces of mushroom and the nutty flavour of the Parmesan cheese filled my whole body. I ate three mouthfuls and sat panting, drained by the vividness of what I'd felt, and wondering if I would have the energy to get upstairs again. Then I heard music from one of the neighbours' houses. It was a piece Serenity had played over and over on her cello when she was learning it a few years back. I closed my eyes and focused until the music seemed to grow louder. I felt like I had never heard that song properly before. Every note started to sound itself out separately, just like the rice grains had done in my mouth. It was like I was going into the song, and it was being magnified in me tenfold, a hundredfold, a thousandfold. I felt like I could listen to the music forever and ever. It was so complex. Following every nuance and flourish, I was on the edge of understanding why Serenity had loved it so much, and the thought drifted into my mind that if I understood, it would tell me something about Serenity and the darkness she was building around her. The music ended, and an announcer told everyone to listen to the latest hit track from The Rack. Electronic music chewed into the bright day, ratty and savage. It was like something alive, trying to gnaw its way into my skull. It made me think of a phobia I used to have when I was little, about an earwig getting into my ear. Some big kid had told me they called them earwigs because what they liked most was crawling into someone's ear and gnawing at their brain to make a little cave for their egg sac. I used to stick plugs of plasticine into my ears to stop the earwigs getting in at night until one melted and the doctor had to remove it. Memory had taken me away from listening for a few seconds and the music had faded. But now, as I listened again, it grew louder and more brutal and vicious until I began to feel sick. I put my hands over my ears, but the music came through, earwigs of sound devouring my brain. I began to feel pain in